Involvement with the criminal justice system is life-changing. It matters.
Having a justice system that works is a really important part of a democratic society.
I'm Penelope Gibbs, Director of Transform Justice.
I'm Rob Allen. I've worked in and around criminal justice all my career.
This is the Transform Justice podcast, throwing light on the criminal justice system.
Hearing from people who know.
It's about whether the system's fair.
And what can be done to make it better.
Today we discuss the pros and cons of a type of court referred to as a problem-solving court. Though, of course, ideally all courts should solve problems. I'm joined by Phil Bowen, Director of the Centre for Justice Innovation, and by Professor Jocelyn Simonson of Brooklyn Law School, and of course by my co-host Rob Allen. Rob, what's your memory of seeing problem-solving courts when you first saw them?
Well, I think the first one I saw was 20-plus years ago in the States, and it was not like a court. There was a judge and a social worker sitting together, and one of my colleagues said, this is more like a GP's surgery. People were kind of discussing what was the problem and what to do to make it better. And one of the people had a drug problem. And at the end of the hearing, it emerged that a bus would arrive for them within an hour to take them to a drug treatment facility. And at the time in the UK, there was a waiting list of several months for that kind of thing. I was pretty encouraged and impressed, as many people were 20 plus years ago.
Phil, given all courts should solve problems, what for you makes a problem-solving court different from any other criminal court?
I mean, I think the two distinctive things are, firstly, some form of interdisciplinary team, and then element two is the judicial monitoring part. What that means is trained judges regularly reviewing the progress that individuals are making according to their plan, to check on compliance, but also to encourage, to motivate, and also to understand where there are bumps in the road, why those are happening, and how the plan can be adjusted.
Can you give an example from the US?
So, sitting in the Chicago courtroom, it was a court list that involved people who had substance use issues, and I was witness to maybe about 20 or 30 people going through with the judge one-on-one, how they were doing against their treatment plan. And, you know, as part of that review, in some cases the judge was saying, this is great progress, maybe we don't need to meet again for another couple of months. And in other cases they were saying, okay, well, there's clearly bumps in the road. How is the team going to respond in a dynamic way to the issues that were going on? There were some cases I remember that were at the end of their road, and there was, the next stage was a graduation ceremony because they'd completed their sentence, they'd done well. And still yet more cases where people hadn't done so well and it was a case of going back to resentencing.
Jocelyn, you worked at Red Hook, a Brooklyn court that was one of the first of these kinds of community courts. How did that kind of differ from other courts in operation at the time?
Yes, my first job out of college before becoming a lawyer was to work at the Red Hook Community Justice Center. It would take cases from a particular set of neighborhoods. And the idea is that it's both a neighborhood center and a place where criminal cases come through. And it was the first multi-jurisdictional community court, and the ideas there have since been replicated. Problem-solving courtrooms are also places that take particular people who are deemed to either be worthy of having a different approach to a criminal case other than just prison or not prison, or have a specific problem that warrants this kind of attention. And so you can find mental health courts, domestic violence courts, or sometimes it's courtrooms that are dedicated to populations that the system thinks are more deserving. So veterans courts or girls courts. And so I have worked in a particular physical courthouse that was designated a problem-solving courthouse. But even there, not everyone got to have drug treatment, and not everyone had a social worker. It's a small part of a larger web of arrests, prosecutions, and criminalizations that from the time when I started working in Red Hook in 2001 was not necessarily common. And now is incredibly common throughout the United States.
Mm. I mean, for those who do make it into these more problem-solving approaches, whether they're separate courtrooms or a different approach, do they get a better result from doing all that? What do you think?
The question, is it better, depends, as you can imagine, on how you think about what's good or what's better. Someone in support of problem-solving courts might say that it's better to treat somebody as a person rather than simply a criminal, to give them any treatment that they might need, and to address the problem that caused the arrest and prosecution rather than assume that prison is the right answer. So if you are looking at two choices, one, send someone to prison, or two, to take the quintessential idea of drugs, to acknowledge that somebody has a substance abuse problem and give them treatment, sure, that's better. Another way to ask if it's better is to look at whether someone is rearrested in the future. Studies actually don't all conclude the same thing, but some studies have shown that for something like a drug court, someone is less likely to be rearrested in the future if they have been given treatment through a drug court rather than given prison.
You've mentioned that there are lots of different kind of problem-solving courts, Jocelyn, domestic abuse courts, mental health, and so on. I mean, in your experience, do some work better than others? And what makes the difference? What makes an effective one as compared to a less effective one? Or is it too hard to say?
You're going to have a hard time getting me to say that any of them are effective. I don't think any of them are effective at solving the social problems they claim to solve. And I don't think any of them are effective at showing compassion to people who are being criminalized in the context of other options that we might have to address harm, violence, substance abuse, mental health issues, homelessness, whatever it might be. And I don't mean to be difficult in answering your question, because I think that it's probably true that if you're measuring, say, recidivism, whether someone's arrested in the future, that some courts are more, quote, effective than others.
Phil, you've also engaged in the New York criminal courts and have observed the spread of problem-solving courts in the States. Why and how have they taken off so much in the USA?
I mean, I think they have taken off in part because there is this growing and maturing evidence base, especially around drug courts, that they seem to reduce recidivism. They seem to reduce the use of incarceration. Some of the other courts that Jocelyn's mentioned, like things like homelessness courts. Now, I remember going to San Francisco and seeing a homelessness court and thinking, why are we taking a law enforcement approach to what is essentially a problem of homelessness? So I think some of the problem-solving courts in the States have arisen because it's seen as an effective approach, but I would question at points whether there's been kind of mission creep into areas where you just think, but this isn't a law enforcement issue, this is a social services issue, et cetera, et cetera. I think part of the reason they've grown in some of the states in the US, an interest from the judiciary to be seen to be doing something, and where that applies, I think sometimes judges have seen problems in their community, have felt constrained by the options they have, which seem to be, either letting people go on sort of discharges or sending them to prison, and problem solving offers some kind of other way of seeming to solve those problems.
Jocelyn, I agree with Phil. I travelled around three US states and I observed problem-solving courts and interviewed the judges. And it struck me that that's where the huge enthusiasm was, that judges who are perhaps frustrated by the normal court system and that they weren't sort of, to be honest, making much difference to the lives of the people that they were convicting, had an outlet for their sort of progressive tendencies. Is that what you see?
So, yes, I think that judges who are frustrated with their lack of options have been some of the biggest advocates for drug courts and problem-solving courts more generally. It also, I think, might sometimes just be frustration with not having a lot of power or discretion in what they're doing. And I say that because as much as I do think some judges are genuinely frustrated with, you know, in the United States, mandatory minimums, like an amount of prison that you have to give somebody if they've been prosecuted. We've also found that these associations of judges who are affiliated with drug courts have later on actually opposed reforms that would reduce the sentences for drug offenses. So I don't think we can conclude that judges who work in drug courts think that we should always be more compassionate or should send people to prison less. But I do think it's true that judges are very involved in doing this. They want to show that they care. They want to do something. Even in criminal court, though, there is another option, which is not to prosecute the case or to dismiss the case. But that is a powerless thing for a judge to do. And it's not something that you're going to, say, run for office on or necessarily give a speech about.
Obviously, yes, some judges in some U.S. states are elected rather than directly employed by the local government. So they often want a story to tell, don't they?
Yes, exactly.
I mean, Phil, I mean, that's an important point, isn't it? In the U.S., judges seem to have a lot more flexibility and power to set up things like courts. And I couldn't imagine a UK judge really being that active in wanting to get something like that going. Is that your view, or do you think that's overstating it a bit?
I think what we have seen, where problem-solving courts do exist, is some form of combination of a judge interested in doing something differently and either explicitly government supporting that, or at the very least, for example, in Manchester with the Women's Problem-Solving Court, yeah, an active probation service that thinks that's a good idea. I can't see a world in the United Kingdom where a judge on their own devices can make this happen, but they can only do it in partnership with others.
Phil, you've referred there to some problem-solving courts that have been set up in the UK. Can you just take us briefly through the rather stuttering history of problem-solving courts here?
I mean, yeah, it is a slightly stuttering history, but I mean, I think we should also recognise that sort of sat here in 2023, we've got 22 family courts that can adopt a problem-solving approach, 12 criminal problem-solving courts, and 3 new pilot areas. But essentially, the New Labour government in the sort of early 2000s got interested in one type of problem-solving court, in particular the community court, and set up the North Liverpool Community Justice Centre. It was then accompanied with a couple of magistrate court drug court pilots around about the same time some drug courts were set up in Scotland. And then we've had various cycles of governments being interested in them. The Lord Chancellor Michael Gove, when he was in power in 2015-16, was interested and set up a working party. That never came to fruition because of Brexit. And then more recently, government has got renewed interest in problem-solving courts, which has led to 3 new problem-solving court pilots being set up and taking their first cases this summer.
Jocelyn, what's the position in the States? Are problem-solving courts still kind of expanding and growing as a phenomenon, or has enthusiasm waned a bit?
I don't think enthusiasm has waned at all among liberal politicians or judges. In fact, I think they've become mainstream. There are tens of thousands of problem-solving courts, depending on how you measure it, throughout the United States. And once it's there, it's hard to get rid of, right? It tends to become part of the institution. Red Hook is still there and going strong, for instance, more than 20 years later.
So, Phil, you referred to the recent revival of interest in England and Wales. This includes the renaming of problem-solving courts as intensive supervision courts. Why have they reframed them, and why the interest reviving in the first place?
And the interest, I think, has come from, a persuasion amongst policymakers that there is something in the evidence base, especially around the drug court model, that we haven't tested in the UK and it's worth testing. And I think we've got a rising prison population, and part of the incentive behind these new pilots is, can we adopt approaches which reduce the use of custody? In terms of the renaming, I've never loved the term problem-solving courts as someone who has at various points advocated for them. It describes people having problems, which I don't think is great. And I think, you know, it would be foolish to say we're solving their problems and that people come out completely fresh and new. Why they have reframed them as intensive supervision courts, that was a political decision because it sounds tougher. But, you know, the people who go through the Crown Court pilots will be subject to treatment packages, which probably will be experienced as relatively intensive. I think that's less the case, and I think it should be less the case for the Birmingham pilot, which is looking at women who are at risk of short-term custody. That, I think they're taking an approach where, you know, a lot of the supervision, a lot of the interventions will be delivered at a women's centre, and I think a lot of the framing around that is much more about compliance and support of women to focus on the things that they need to do to build their own assets and their own sort of self-efficacy.
Jocelyn, what do you think of this renaming these courts as intensive supervision? Presumably it kind of illustrates your point about these things not necessarily being as progressive as people think.
It sounds incredibly honest to me. I love the new name. That's what it is. It's intensive supervision, and it's intensive, I would add the word carceral supervision, with the threat of prison if you don't do what the court's supervising you and the court officers are saying you have to do. I had a lot of clients go through drug court courtrooms, and it does not feel like a compassionate experience when you're in there, even with a judge who very much cares and agrees that a lot of people are arrested and some of the reasons behind that have to do with substance abuse rather than them being an inherently bad person. Even when you come in with that vibe, let's be clear, to be sent to a drug treatment facility because the alternative is prison is very different than going to a drug treatment facility voluntarily. And so if we're thinking about this as compassionate and caring or claiming to be solving a problem, that doesn't feel honest to me. To say instead of sending people to prison, we're going to try to do intensive supervision not in prison and punish them, by the way, by putting them in jail for short amounts of time if they use drugs again. That feels to me more honest.
I have to say that the punishment for not keeping to the, you know, sentence in England and Wales is never prison if you use drugs again. We are not so strict. But if you don't keep to the terms of the supervision, you can be imprisoned. I'm right, aren't I, Phil?
Yeah, you're right. In the new intensive supervision pilots, in particular the two Crown Court ones, the people who should be eligible for that court are people who are facing up to 2 years of prison, and therefore they're getting the intensive package of support as an alternative to prison. Part of that will be drug testing, but testing positive is not going to be treated on its own as breachable. If there is a pattern of non-compliance more generally that involves also positive drug tests, judges will be taking that into consideration.
But Phil, there is the threat of prison for breach, isn't there?
All of the courts will have a process of incentives and sanctions. One of the sanctions can be short use of prison, but then you return to the program. The expectation, certainly discussing with practitioners, is if people have already got to the point where they're really not in compliance, they're more likely just to be resentenced than use those short custodial powers.
I mean, Jocelyn, I hear you're kind of skeptical about the role that courts should be playing in getting people into treatment, and it's probably better if it's undertaken voluntarily. But isn't there a point that the authority of the court can, in some cases, encourage people at a, I think the phrase is, a teachable moment or some kind of moment in their lives of crisis where they might say, actually, I do want to change. And here, under the court's authority, it's more likely that I'm going to give it a go. Is that not a plausible scenario?
Sure. It's a plausible scenario in individual circumstances. But again, I think that's thinking about it in kind of a limited series of choices about how we as a community or the government itself approaches or treats someone with a substance abuse problem, as opposed to taking a step back and asking what are the other resources that have been, are now, or will be available to prevent people from drug use, or even to reduce the harm in their lives from drug use. When I was practicing, people would be given the threat of years in prison for not going to treatment for marijuana use. Now, marijuana use is now more legal in New York State than it is in other states. So it might not be true that regular use of marijuana always requires the intensive money, time, and attention that drug treatment can take. And to be clear, if you're in drug court, at least when I was practicing, you would have to report to court regularly. So you have to skip a day of work or school once every 2 weeks. You have to go to treatment every day. You have to pay for parts of your treatment. So the idea that all of that is better than having this person living in a neighborhood where they're able to afford housing, they have a job that pays them well so that they can support their family, even if they're using drugs, I think is already making an assumption about what we want to do with the money that the government has, with the resources that nonprofits or, you know, community organizations have. There are so many kind and loving social workers in these courts. What if they weren't doing it in a criminal court where someone's being threatened with putting in a cage, and instead we're doing it in a community resource center and using other methods of persuasion, but not coercion, to offer services that people might need? There are a lot of things that are real problems, right? So I don't want to say that problem-solving courts aren't addressing real societal problems. But the assumption that this is the way we solve those problems, instead of making sure that people have the resources, I think applies to all kinds of drug use, all kinds of mental health issues, and domestic violence as well.
But isn't this a way of actually getting people at a particular moment in their time something that wouldn't normally be available to them?
Yes, that's the problem. The way that you get a bed in a treatment program is by being arrested and threatened with prison. And that same drug treatment program will say, we do not have any beds available. So we're systematically making a decision that the way we're going to get people the treatment they need is by using the violence of the criminal court system. And it's just not how we have to do it.
Phil, you know, we like to think at least that we have a richer, more generous welfare state. We have a free NHS and so on. So in view of that, how do you respond to Jocelyn's criticism of the gatekeeping done by the problem-solving courts?
I absolutely recognise what Jocelyn was describing, and I remember being shocked by it when I was in the Bronx. And I don't think that's the case in England and Wales. You know, you can walk into your GP and say, I've got a drug problem and I need treatment. Now, whether you get that quickly and the quality of that treatment is a different matter. I think what Rob said a little while ago about the sort of teachable moment, I mean, one of the things that we hear from people who've gone through things like the Family Drug and Alcohol Court is this was the time, after years of people offering me treatment and me either refusing or flunking out of it, with the threat of my children being taken away from me, this is the time I decided to take this seriously. Now, I also agree with Jocelyn that we should be doing more work to divert people away from the system in the first place. There is then a second, much broader conversation around our attitude to drugs more generally, and whether having a prohibitionist stance on drug possession has really worked. But I think given the system that we have, we should be diverting more people. And when there is no alternative but prosecution, I think a problem-solving court approach is better than prison.
And Jocelyn, in talking about imprisonment, what is the evidence in terms of the impact on prison numbers of problem-solving courts in the States? Does it seem to be reducing prison numbers?
In some places, there is evidence that people are less likely to be rearrested if they've been through a drug court instead of been sent to prison. It's certainly true that in jurisdictions where a drug court alternative is available, that some people will successfully complete their treatment, not do prison time, and therefore there will be less prison time. I should say it's also true that if you, quote, fail drug court, however you measure it, you are often going to go to prison for a longer time, at least in the United States, than you would have otherwise if you didn't go to drug court. So it doesn't save prison time for everybody.
But why would you go for longer? Is it sort of just like, we gave you a chance and you failed, you didn't take this wonderful chance that we offered you?
Yes, it's something like that. It has to do with how we plea bargain in the United States. But you're actually agreeing to do this thing, and the threat in the back end is you're going to go to prison for a longer amount of time than you would have.
I mean, part of the issue might be that we're talking about different kinds of cases here, that maybe they are very low-level stuff that you're talking about, Jocelyn, in the States, that in over here in England and Wales would probably be dealt with by the kind of diversion that Phil's talked about, cautions, warnings, this kind of thing.
I'm not so sure about that, Rob. We're building 20,000 more prison places and we put a lot through our courts, which is quite low level.
Sat in the Bronx Criminal Court, I saw cases that would get nowhere near a courthouse in the UK. You know, people being arrested for being in the wrong public housing without documentation. I was like, what is this as a criminal offence? I'm not saying there aren't stupid low-level cases in our courts that we could deal with in a much better way, but the dimensions of it were astonishing, I think, and I would imagine if I went back there this year, I would still be quite astonished by just the volume of cases going through that court.
I think you would. I just wanted to add to that, that there are cases that I think you might consider serious that go through problem-solving courts here in the U.S. In New York State, the law actually changed to allow so-called violent crimes to be brought into drug court. So assault, robbery might still come in. So again, something that everyone, if it did happen, everyone would say is a problem. And I would still make all of those same points I just made about how the state should respond to something like that. I don't think that criminal courts and policing are the answer to most, if not all, forms of way that people hurt each other. And I think that when we start to think about how we spend our money and resources and how we support communities and think about the trauma and the abuse and the substance abuse that lies behind even serious offenses, I think some of these questions are equally, if not more, important.
So, Jocelyn, what I'm hearing from you is a kind of desire, as it were, to defund the courts, to get the resources elsewhere. Do you actually see problem-solving courts as a barrier to that argument about defunding the courts altogether?
It is an enormous barrier. In a place like New York City where I live, there is a tentative general consensus that we send too many people to jail or prison. And the idea that the way to have fewer people in jail is to have problem-solving courts means that instead of defunding the courts, we are spending more money on courts. And therefore, we are in New York City closing down libraries, building fewer homeless shelters, defunding our schools in favor of giving the district attorneys and our criminal courts more money for problem-solving courts. So it's a monetary barrier and it's a political barrier to trying to solve social problems without using criminal courts. And then it gives politicians the ammunition to say, homeless shelters don't solve the problem because look, we still have the problem. But yet we haven't put the money, the resources, the energy into trying to solve these problems in other ways.
Okay. It's been a fascinating discussion. I think we must sadly draw it to a close. What I'd like to ask each of you in turn, if I can, is if you were in charge of the court system, if there was one thing that you would do to try and improve outcomes for defendants, but also in terms of reducing crime and general social benefit, what would it be? Phil, what would you do?
I think adopting the principles of problem solving, procedural fairness, treating people with respect and decency, and for some cases, adopting a explicit problem-solving court approach is what I would like to see more of. I would caveat that with, we need to test it out. Is it reducing reoffending? Is it reducing the use of prison for those people? If not, then we need to rethink. But I would strongly advocate for thinking that it will. And I think if we're to have courts at all doing that kind of work, I think the principles of problem solving are pretty well evidence based.
What would you do, Jocelyn?
I think better criminal courts means fewer criminal courts and fewer cases. So if I were in charge of just the criminal system, I would try to take some of my funding, move it outside of the system, tell police to arrest fewer people, and tell prosecutors to prosecute fewer people. What I would love to be is in charge of the system, as in the government, right? And there, I would focus all of our energy outside of criminal courts and outside of policing, in meeting people where they are, trying to prevent violence, trying to give communities the resources that they need to prevent harm, and then to deal with harm without using prison. What I would say is we have enough problem-solving courts. Let's try to solve problems in other ways.
Rob, what would you do if you were in charge?
I'd like to see it more of an emphasis on problem-solving diversion rather than problem-solving courts. We've got an opportunity in England and Wales through a new system of keeping cases out of courts. I think that needs investing in rather than investing in or alongside investing in problem-solving courts themselves.
Thanks, Rob, Phil and Jocelyn. And do refer to our programme notes to find out more about problem-solving courts, about the Centre for Justice Innovation, and about Jocelyn's new book. And do drop us a line if you have an idea for another podcast. Thanks for listening. Bye.